ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm very pleased to tell you Chris Hayward is here today. Chris is an actor who grew up in England. He came to Australia in the 1970s, and he went on to become an instantly recognisable figure in so many seminal Australian films and TV series, from Newsfront to The Man from Snowy River to Breaker Morant, from Muriel's Wedding to Beneath Hill 60 to the films of Paul Cox. I think Chris brings the same intensity to his quietly dramatic roles as he does to his wildly comedic performances. And I think he's one of those actors that makes you smile when he enters a scene, when you're sitting in the cinema, because you know that Chris is going to give us all a good time. Chris has always given off the impression of a man who's seen and done a few things off screen. His performances are all informed by some off-the-wall life experiences. As a boy, Chris Hayward was a Navy cadet, and today he lives with his family on the New South Wales Central Coast, where he continues to mess about with boats, and he's appearing in a new Australian movie called The Way, My Way. Hello, Chris.
G'day, Richard.
You've been working for a while on a pearl farm on the Central Coast. What were you doing on that?
Well, I was using every skill that I had, really. I have a coxswain's ticket, so I could drive the vessels there, but also I was guiding people through the process of growing pearl oysters and then retrieving the pearls from the oysters. So at Moonee Moonee, which is in the next little suburb to where I live, Brooklyn, there is a section of the waterfront there where all the oyster farmers have their sheds, and the pearl farm has a shed there, and it's called, believe it or not, the Sheller Door. And you can go and visit that, and you can see the beautiful pearls that are grown in on the Hawkesbury and in Brisbane waters. And you can learn all about the history of pearling in Australia. And if you want to, you can jump on one of their boats there and go out on a conducted tour. I no longer do that. I'm involved in history tours now around there, amongst other things.
That place is famously one of the most beautiful spots on God's green earth, around the Hawkesbury River in New South Wales.
Yeah.
Is it hard to get you out of there these days?
Very. It is. It's very hard. I love it there.
You've always enjoyed messing about in boats, like I said. Tell me about the village in Essex in the UK where you spent your earliest years, Chris.
Well, my first memories are of a little house in a village called Great Baddo, which is in Essex. And it's just a small village with a little stream that runs through it, but it has one peculiar aspect, an enormous tower, which in fact was the test tower for the Marconi Company as they developed radar. Even before the Second World War, they were working to try and find some way of identifying things using radio waves. And my father, who was a young man at that stage, was in a reserved occupation working for Marconi, developing that to help Britain in the war. So not that I was aware of that. The sort of things I remember is a white rabbit hopping across the lawn and disappearing through the paling fence into the neighbour's garden. But we moved from there into Chelmsford itself to be closer to where Dad was working, and lived in a type of house that was popping up all over England, which were prefabricated houses that they were using to replace the many buildings that were lost, you know, into the bombing in the Second World War. And we were there for, I think, about 2 years or something like that.
Yeah, you lived in Buckinghamshire for a while, didn't you?
That's right.
Yeah.
So then we moved to Buckinghamshire.
And what do you remember of that place?
Well, the first place we went to was called Penn Street. Now, it wasn't it's not like a street name. It wasn't Penn Street in that sense.
It's the name of the town, was it? Penn Street.
It was this tiny village, yeah. And street, it comes from the Roman naming of any paved roadway. And there was a paved Roman roadway that went between the town of Amersham and I think the town of High Wycombe. And Penn was halfway along that street, so it was called Penn Street. And this was a typical little village for this area, which was principally a furniture-making area. So there was one factory that made furniture, and there were beautiful beech forests, and beech is a lovely, smooth-grained tree that you can see in some of the finer furniture out of England. That forest came right up to the edge of the village, and then as it bordered the village, they'd planted rhododendrons all through there, so when they were flowering, it was a great entry into the woods where we would play. And then from that point on, it was just high ferns, and we would play over and under through the ferns and have pathways you could see and then others you couldn't, you know.
That sounds quite bucolic. What did you do for pocket money?
Ah, well, I actually had my first paid job there. There was a little church in the village, and I used to go to the Sunday school, and then they suddenly wanted someone. It had one of those hand-powered organs that, you know, the organist plays there, with a big lever on the side that you pumped up and down.
Was that you?
That was me. It was one penny a service, yeah.
So that, one penny to pump the organ for an entire service, essentially.
That's correct, yes.
Were your family a churchy family?
Well, I was sent to Sunday school, you know, from my that's some of my earliest memories, and that continued right the way through until I was about 14 or 15 when we moved out of Penn Street into the main town, or just on the edge of the main town of High Wycombe. I joined the church choir, and it was a fabulous choir. It actually, these days, it sings with the choir from St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle.
And did that expose you to a lot of, you know, beautiful old church music?
It did. It really did. Yeah, beautiful anthems, you know. I mean, you'd sit at the end of a service as the organist played the congregation out to some classical piece of organ anthem music. It was stunning.
You know, people used to sing together too.
Well, it was a proper choir, and you know, you'd get a halfpenny for a rehearsal, penny a service, and half a crown a wedding or funeral.
How would you get to school in the wintertime in such a place?
Oh, you'd walk, because the buses couldn't get up the hills because of the snow, and so you would walk across the hills. There were rolling hills between the house and the school. You didn't think anything of it, because that was the world that was.
You played rugby at school. What were you like as a player, Chris?
I enjoyed it. I was a hooker. They put us up against some pretty heavyweight teams, and I'd got knocked around a few times. And eventually, I was actually withdrawn by the school from rugby and put in the back of a rowing eight as the cox, and so I became the cox of the first eight. I'd taken too many knocks, I think.
Were you a studious kid?
Well, not really. No, I don't understand all that part of my life, really, because prior to going to this grammar school, it was a grammar school that was started by Queen Elizabeth I, and it was called the Royal Grammar School, High Wycombe. It was, a pretty good school. It had a great music department and a great art department, painting. I loved all of that sort of stuff, plus the compulsory cadets, and they had a Latin stream and a classical Greek stream and proper wonderful science laboratories. But for some reason, when I got into the second year, I really started to have trouble concentrating on stuff. And it could have been from taking a few knocks on the head, I thought later, but I didn't think anything of it at the time, other than, oh, what shall I do? And so I used to quietly walk out of the school and catch the train to London, and then visit the different museums. The Science Museum was a favourite, and the galleries, and that was my days then.
How did you get away with that?
No one seemed to notice too much. I must say that, you know, in some of the classes, the students would really give the masters a serve. They'd add names to the class list, and when they had a roll call at the beginning, you know, we'd just take it in turns to say, "Oh, here, sir," and there wasn't anyone there. So you'd have someone would cover for you, just say, "Here, sir," but you wouldn't be there. You know, they never noticed. But one occasion I did have, I'd got some punishment drills that I had to do with it. You know, you'd had to march up and down for an hour and a half or something. I didn't want to do that, so I popped out at lunchtime and got into a phone box and rang the school and told them I was my dentist and that I'd missed an appointment the day before. Could Hayward come in that afternoon and have his treatment then? They said, "Oh, just a minute, we'll put you on to his form master." Oh, God. And then I blew it. So when the form master answered the phone, I said, "Oh, hello, sir. This is Hayward's dentist here." I shouldn't have said hello, sir. Yeah, that was a giveaway. But in any case, I spun him out this whole tale, and then he said, "Oh, right here, we'll let him know." And then I thought, oh, good, it's worked. went back to the school, and then one of the other boys came up and said, "Oh, Mr. McTavish wants to see you at the staff room." I went there. He said, "Do you have a dental appointment, Hayward?" I said, I had one yesterday, sir, but I missed it." And he said, "Oh, we had a phone call from someone who said they were your dentist." He said, "Unfortunately, Mr. Morgan, who was the acting headmaster, plays golf with your dentist, and he overheard the call and said, 'No, that wasn't Dr. Baker. So I think you better go up and see Mr. Morgan. You know, I got six of the best.'" And
nonetheless, it was your first acting performance.
It was.
Your first role.
Yeah, it was, you know, a rehearsal at least.
Critics were harsh.
They were very harsh, yeah.
Literally flogged.
Flogged it, yeah.
For not being convincing in that role.
We didn't get a second night.
As a teenager, you became a Navy cadet. Why a Navy cadet?
I had an uncle who was in the Fleet Air Arm, and as a child we would holiday with that uncle and aunt and their kids. They were the closest sort of members of our family, and they were always stationed in quite remote areas on the naval air stations, like Haverford West in Wales or Lossiemouth in the northeast of Scotland. So they were always fabulous places to visit, and I used to do a lot of trout fishing with my cousin. And in Wales, you know, in those days, the milkman would run around with his milk in a little carry thing and deliver it to you. Up there in Wales, the milkman was a Welsh international rugby player with a horse and cart, and so I really enjoyed running around with him and delivering milk and doing all of that sort of kid stuff, you know. But boats fascinated me, and what I learnt through the cadets I've used much more, I think, than any of the sort of academic elements of schooling.
Like what? What did you learn?
Well, we started off, I can use basically most styles of firearm. So you were taught to use pistols, 9mm pistols, 303 rifles, LMGs, light machine guns, Bren guns, heavy machine guns, all of that. So you were very competent in handling a weapon. You knew your safety and you knew what it was like to handle weapons. That was good. One of the most fascinating things was my uncle tipped me off that they were going to run a course on an introduction to space travel. And this was about 1964, I think, or 65.
Right. So after Sputnik, after Yuri Gagarin, but not before the moon landings.
That's right.
Yep. Right.
Yep.
Wow. So how badly did you want to go into space?
Well, I didn't mind. If that came up, I was quite happy to do it, you know. They did they took us up in the Vomit Comet, you know, and did the weightlessness travel through the air by taking the plane through the parabolic arc. As you reach the top of the arc, as it starts to dive, you think that you're in a weightlessness situation because the aircraft's body is falling at the speed of gravity.
Oh, Chris, so I've always wanted to do that, but I just don't have the courage or the stomach, I don't think. How was it for you to be in that vomit comet?
Oh, it was fantastic. You know, the chief petty officer looking after us said, you know, "Just make sure when I say back to your seats, you get back there quickly, because as it pulls out, of course, then you get a massive G-force as it pulls out the bottom of the dive." Well, not massive, but a significant G-force. And if you're not in the seat, you'll hit the floor, you know.
And was it like to be weightless for those, what, seconds that you're weightless for?
It was pretty magic. And then we did, what do they call it, a recovery, a helicopter with a big scoop net would pick you up and, you know, pick you up off the ground, and you got used to travelling in those.
So having done all those things, I just wonder if that's given you a certain, when it comes to acting, a certain degree of, I don't know, fearlessness maybe. Is that too strong a word?
No. It's not fearlessness, it's trust. It's that belief. If someone says, when you do this, this will happen, and you go, okay, I believe that, and you do it as they've told you to do it, then invariably what they've told you, if they're knowledgeable, like a stunt coordinator or somebody like that, what they've told you will happen. If you hesitate or don't do exactly what they say, you can get seriously hurt.
What gave you the idea that you could go to acting school then?
Oh, I was working in a wine cellar, and we had a student who came in at the weekends to drive the delivery van. And he came in one day and said, "Oh, I'm going to drama school." And I went, "What? You know, what's so special about this guy? Why is he going to drama school?" And I asked him all about how he got to drama school, and he told me, and I said, "Well, what about if I want to go?" He said, "Well, you'll have to ring them up, make an appointment, go for an audition." So I did. I rang them up, And they said, oh, well, we've closed the books for this year. If you want to prepare 3 classical pieces and 4 modern, we'll see you sometime next year. And I said, no, it has to be this year. And they said, well, our last audition is on Friday, which was 2 days away. They said, can you prepare for that? I said, oh, yeah, no worries, don't worry about a thing. I turned up 2 days later. I hadn't learned anything. And I couldn't. I didn't know how to. I hadn't got the first idea. But the other fella told me exactly what he'd done when he did his audition. And basically, I just did what he did. And when it came to the piece of doing the bits from the plays, I said, well, I'm sorry I haven't had time to learn those, but I can read it for you, you know, and sort of bluff my way through that. And the head of the school gave me a couple of other pieces to read, because this was the time of the, you know, the socio-realist movement was starting. So it was easy for me to sort of fall into that. And then the killer was this. She asked me what she thought the relationship was between politics and the theatre. And at that time, I was chairman of the Young Liberals in the town that I lived in. And this is not the Conservative Liberals, this is the radical political Liberals.
The closest thing to what the Australian Democrats were back in the day, essentially. Exactly. The centrist sort of party,
that's
as they
it.
Were. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So that was easy.
I kind of almost see this as a kind of golden age when suddenly Britain began to realise that the stories of everyday people were every bit, maybe even more compelling, the story of the powerful, the famous and the rich.
Absolutely.
And you're hearing the voices of working class and ordinary people on the stage and on the screen, and you get all those great TV dramas, great TV comedies that came out of Britain at the time. Was that part of the training? Were you the beneficiary of that great revolution in British drama?
I believe so. Well, the school itself came out of the theatre workshop, which was in Stratford, East London, and the school was called E15, which was the postal district for Stratford. Well, what happened was that the actors decided that they would start a drama school to get the street kids off the streets. And a lot of them lived in the terraces that were either side of the theatre. And they knocked some of the internal walls down up in the attics, and they started up there. And it was successful in doing what they'd set out to do. And it was eventually recognised by the Inner London Education Authority, and they gave them an old Georgian manor house on the edge of Epping Forest.
Tell me about the man who taught you improvisation at this school, please.
Improvisation was very much, I mean, every one of the tutors would work with us improvising stuff a lot of the time. It was a way into understanding scripts. You would take a scene and work out what the main purpose of the character and things like that was in a scene, and then throwing the script aside, you would then recreate it. Or you would create a completely new story just by someone saying, well, let's have a milkman and a politician and 3 ladies who are just knitting on a bench, and then threw in more information, you know, and things would start. Now, it was so successful that the rest of the theatre world started to really acknowledge what was going on there, and students would come in from the more established schools in the city to see this type of work, but also directors would come and view, and one of those was Mike Lee.
Mike Lee. Yeah. Mike Lee came in to teach improvisation.
He came in to learn improvisation.
To learn improvisation.
Yeah,
wow.
He came in to learn how it worked and to see how he could exploit it to make films or to write stories.
Now, one of the greatest British directors since the war, of course. Did he then use improvisation techniques in his movies subsequently to that?
He did, yeah. So if you look at the timetabling of a Mike Lee movie, there is a massive rehearsal period, which in fact is that improvisation period. Now, it's not to be confused with, they weren't improvising once they started filming. The improvisation was used to create the script, to create the story, and then they would take the best parts and compress that down to write a script which would turn into a film.
How were you taught to bring out or to draw out big emotions for a scene?
The best is to actually get yourself into a state of mind where you're going through yourself the issues which are causing the great emotion. And so you're not performing it, you're being it. And if you can achieve that, that's obviously the best of all.
Do you do that at some risk to yourself?
I don't think so. No. I don't think it's ever been a problem for me when I've done it. I would say that in life I often used to put on a bit of an act, a bit of an emotional act if I wanted to achieve something, and I knew that emotion would be the way to get it, you know. I mean, that...
Well, most people do that, but you can just probably do it very well, I suppose.
Could be that, yeah. But as an actor, you learn that... Well, I have this thought about acting, which is that, particularly for film acting or television acting, where there are a lot of technical restraints, and even on the stage in theatre, there are technical restraints on what you can do and where you can go. So you have to have sort of two brains working at once. One is your emotional brain and one is your technical brain. And so you have to be able to switch between the two or take a balance of a bit of each, depending on exactly what you have to do. So if you've gone through and rehearsed a scene with the director, say, for a film, and you're getting to this point where the emotional event is going to happen, you can let the director know and the cameraman know the sort of extent of your range of movement and things like that. And then if they're all happy with that and it's lit for that and they're aware that you could be moving here and there and they've got a few focus marks and things set up for themselves, you can then head into that scene without any thought of the technical sort of restrictions and just let yourself go with the emotion.
So 1970 arrives.
Ah, yeah.
And you come to Australia. What brought you out here in the first place?
Well, I had two friends who had gone through drama school at the same time as I did, and they were coming back to Australia. And they said to me, why don't you go to Australia? And I said, oh, I couldn't afford that. They said, no, you could migrate and pay £10 and then come that way. I said, oh, how do I do that? They said, you go to Australia House and you tell them, you know, that you've got people who will act as your sponsors when you get there and you've got a job and all of that. So, of course, I went there and they said they would act as sponsors. And I went into Australia House and said, well, look, I'm an actor and they're crying out for me there. They just haven't got enough actors and all of that. And the bloke went, Anyway, they filled out all the paperwork. And that was July of 1970, and I was here by November, and I came by plane, which was amazing.
What did you know about Australia before you got here?
Nothing, and very, very little. I mean, I was a bit of a petrol head, I suppose, car maniac. I had books of all the cars in the world, and I went through those thinking, ooh, what shall I get when I get there? But I could only find two cars in one of these books. There was a Holden and an Austin. God, they haven't got any cars there. I better learn to ride a horse. So
Seriously.
So I went.
You went to learn to ride a horse because you thought there would be only two kinds of cars in Australia.
Yeah, not enough to go around.
There was a car shortage here.
Well, that's why I didn't know. No one had said anything, you know. So I went off and learned to ride. And in Epping Forest, you know, in the English hacking style and all of that. And when I got here, of course, a lot of historical stories were being made by the ABC and other producers where they wanted actors who could ride, and there weren't a lot of them. So I was very lucky in I sort of fell on my feet for that, but I also realised there's a big difference in the riding styles between the British hacking style and the Stockman style and the bushranger style and all the rest of it. So I then spent a lot of time riding just to get into all the different styles, so I felt completely at home.
Tell me about your first 24 hours in Australia when you got off the plane.
Oh, I couldn't believe it. It was 90 degrees Fahrenheit. But my friends who picked me up at the airport said, don't worry, we're going to the beach. Oh, the beach? Oh, great. We drove from Sydney Airport to Whale Beach and stayed there for the weekend in a little sandstone cottage on Marlow Road, overlooking the beach. And there was a party that night, or that afternoon, that went into the night. And all these drama students from NIDA were there and people from the theatre and everything else. It was a wonderful event. And eventually, you know, I got to bed. And I was given a sort of a day bed in the front room, which was still made up for the winter with a great big thick eiderdown, I'd call it then, Baduna, we'd call it now. And I climbed into there and said goodnight to everyone and lay there. And after a while, I could feel the sweat pouring off me. I thought, oh, I better get rid of this doona. I can probably just sleep here in my underpants or whatever. I looked down, and on this doona was a tarantula. Well, I thought it was a tarantula. The only spider I'd ever seen of that size was in a James Bond movie. And when Bond saw it, he said, "Don't move. If you don't move, it won't bite you." And I thought, "Oh, I better not move." Right, so I just lay there all night, sweating, watching this spider until the first people got up for coffee in the morning. And as they came in, I said, "Shh, shh, careful, careful, there's a tarantula on the bed." And they said, "Oh, no." They said, "That's a huntsman." And just came over, brushed it off, and I went, "Oh, well, it's not dangerous?" "No," they said, "they're everywhere." You know, like I thought, "Oh, this is an interesting place." Oh.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can find more Conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
You were in the very wholesome wartime drama, The Sullivans, but also in the slightly less wholesome drama, Alvin Purple.
Oh, yeah.
Appeared in that as well.
Yeah.
So you were starting to get work very quickly, but were your roles somewhat restricted by your now almost gone English accent?
Yeah, yeah. At the time, I would go to audition for or see directors for different roles, and they would say, "Oh, no, no, sorry, this is for an Australian." And I'd say, "Well, I am an Australian." And they said, "But what about your accent?" I said, "Yeah, I'm a migrant Australian." The first work I did was understudying a Jim Sharman Shakespeare at the Old Tote. But at the same time, someone offered me a job understudying King O'Malley at the Richbrook. And I took that job as well. So I took two jobs as understudies, but I didn't tell each company I was understudying in the other one. And I just prayed that, you know, I didn't have to go on both theatres on the one night. And luckily, I got right through the whole season of both shows without a clash of commitments, as it were. But I went on from that to go into the show of King O'Malley, which became Australia's entry into the first South Pacific Arts Festival in Fiji. And as you're probably aware, King O'Malley is sort of set against a revivalist religious meeting as the style of the show. And in Fiji, the poor audience there thought we were revivalists. And when we did this bit, when we would go around with the plate, which, you know, we didn't expect anybody to put anything on, we would end up with stacks and stacks of donations every night.
The collection plate, right?
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
The fact that you did have an English accent, did that often mean you were often cast as outsiders?
That's right, I was. I mean, if you look at any country's storytelling, the heroes are normally, you know, the archetypal character of that country, you know? Jack Thompsons and people like that, you know, they're really Australian. People can identify that image so strongly. But, of course, with the historical pieces, the characters had English accents. They didn't have the cross accent of Irish English or, you know, all the different accents that have come together to create the Australian accent. So it worked in my favour too.
Your film career started really in earnest when you played Chris Hewitt in the Philip Noyce movie Newsfront. Tell me about how your character perished in that film, in the Hunter Valley flood scene that was part of
that
film.
We had a mock-up of the Maitland High Street built in the Narrabeen Lakes. So there were these flats that were the front of all the shops and all that. And they had these very large jet boats staked to the bed of the lake so that when they started the engines up, the boats wouldn't move, but the water would, along with industrial water pumps that was pumping the water through the set to give the appearance of the floods. My character in this gets washed off the roof of a tin shed that he's taken refuge on into the water and then trapped underwater and die. Unfortunately for the production, and, you know, it was my fault really, I was out the night before we shot this in Surrey Hills and went to a strange old nightclub that used to be there called Hazy Days, a pretty rugged sort of spot, but I got in a fight. And I caught one on the face, split one side of my face open. We escaped, though. They didn't knock us down. We stayed up, and there was about three or four of us, and fought our way out and as I say, saved ourselves. But I had this split in the face and I went to St. Vinny's and I said, oh, look, can you stitch this up so you can't see it? I've got a job tomorrow where they've got to see my face. And they said, no, we can't actually do that. But we could make very small stitches so it won't leave a big mark later on, you know. So I said, oh, okay, we'll do that then. The next day I go to the set and I say, I'm sorry, I can't shoot that side of my face. See, I've got this mark here. And they said, oh, God. But that's all right. It was quite simple, you know. You just stay side onto the camera.
Profile, right.
Yeah, yeah. And so we get to this part. I get swept off the top of the shed into this fast-flowing stream. A big log comes tumbling along through the water behind me, bowls me over and pins me to the bottom of the lake. Now, that's in the story structure, right? So my hand is supposed to come up and wave and then slowly it disappears, you know. But in fact, I was trapped under the log on the bottom of the lake. But I thought, oh, what do I do next? It's hand up, that's right. I'll do all the acting bit and then I'll try and get out. So I should tell you that Vince Monton, who was the cinematographer, tried to match and did match at every historical sort of change in the time frames as we moved through that story. He'd always get the right film stock. And for that particular part, it was black and white stock of a particular type, which they had just one roll of.
Right. And this is the original news footage of the thing, is it, from back in the day? Right.
This is because it had to cut into original news footage.
Right.
It had to be
to match. Right.
It had to match.
Right.
The stock had to match. They had one roll of it. This is in the camera. The camera rolled. I fell off the roof. The log came down. I go underwater. The hand comes up and I'm going, oh, I am stuck. Up on the top there, Noyce and Monton are standing behind the camera going, die, you bastard, die. How much footage is left? And just as they can hear the end of the spool rattling through the magazine, my hand went down. And three or four frames after that, that was the end of the footage. And then I was struggling and struggling. Eventually I came up.
You and Wendy Hughes had befriended each other.
I met her the very first day that I arrived in Australia, but I didn't, you know, there was this stunningly beautiful woman. I didn't have any notes on myself that I thought I might, you know, end up with her. But when we did Newsfront, we did end up together and we lived together for some years and we have a wonderful daughter.
How immediate was that falling in love?
Pretty much instantaneous. I mean, we'd seen each other around and, you know, given ourselves like, you know, a bit of a smile and the eye and all of that. But when we started to stay together, it was pretty obvious it was good fun for both of us. It was really magic.
What were you like together as a couple in those early years together before you had kids, before you had any of those kind of responsibilities?
Being pretty actors? Outrageous. Wendy was unbelievable. I would say she was more outrageous than me in some senses of the word. I used to drive at that time a 1963 powder blue Eldorado, Cadillac Eldorado convertible, left-hand drive. And, you know, we would just romp our way around the parties at the weekends and stuff, get back home late in the morning, have a cup of coffee and perhaps another champagne or something, and then make a decision to go to the beach. And she would have got out of her clothes that she was in for the night before and just put on a fur coat, that was all. And then we'd leap in the old caddy and tear down to Watson's Bay and wander around the headland there and lie on the grass and welcome the dawn.
But there are times when you could hardly believe you'd been this lucky, Chris. You're getting all this work. You're in this place that seems like a paradise to you. Could you hardly believe your good luck in all of this?
Oh, from the day I arrived here. Well, firstly, you know, you arrive in Australia. You've escaped all the class structure of England, all of it. You can only do that if you've come from that background or that background. Here I was in this great country of freedoms where anybody could do basically what they wanted, as long as you didn't, you know, bugger it up for somebody else, as it were. But it was just magic. It was unbelievable that there was that extreme sort of difference. I've been listening recently to some extraordinary writings on the First World War. I'm just listening to a book that was written by one of the five official war correspondents for the British government during that time. And the description of the Aussies in there and their attitude to everybody else. Young men who were lean and out there. They'd obviously come from the country. They had great energy. They weren't soporific or anything. They just got into everything. And this was what I was seeing. It was fabulous.
You then appeared in The Man from Snowy River, and like you said, you learned a bit of hacking in England,
yeah, no,
to prepare yourself for the carless Australia that you thought you'd encounter when you got here. But you said it didn't really prepare you all that well for the kind of horse riding that was required for The Man from Snowy River.
Yeah, I mean, stockman riding and, you know, wrangler and even bushranger, you know, they're pretty knockabout sort of people. The saddles are different for a start, things like that. But I was very lucky that I befriended Heath Harris, who used to have a big horse ranch, I suppose you'd call it, at Tumbledown Dick, between Mona Vale and Terry Hills. And I would stay there. If he went away, I'd say, well, what can I ride, Heath? He said, don't ride any stallions, don't ride any rigs, you know, but you can ride most everything else. And so, of course, once he went away, I got the stallions out and the rigs out and tried everything and, of course, ended up in a big fight with the rig. A rig is a horse that's not properly cut. It's a stallion that has been neutered, but it hasn't worked. He's still got a lot of the toe that stallions have. And this one reared up and struck me on the shoulder with a massive blow for his hoof. And I'd still got a nose rein on him, and I thought, I wonder what I'll do. And I thought, I'll just get him down a bit. And I gave him a great big whack on the nose, and he pulled up. And I got him settled down and then walked him around and round and then got a saddle on him and rode him.
How did you go in the fight scenes in The Man from Snowy River?
Oh, they were good. They were good. It's choreographed well, but you need people who have had experience in fighting. Luckily, as a kid, I did judo as my, you know, it was one of the sports I did. And the thing about judo is you're taught to fall. So you can fall from basically any position and land in a fashion that you're not going to hurt yourself. But it doesn't look like you've deliberately saved yourself necessarily. So if we're doing a fight scene, you see a punch, one punch in the story, but that would have happened perhaps 8, 9, 10 times when we were filming, because it would be shot in a wide and then a close-up from this position and a mid-shot from over there. So perhaps 8 times you would do it and fall. There's a scene where Tom Burlinson, as the man from Snowy River, you know, throws a punch at my character. And he hadn't done a lot of fighting, I think, at that time. And he caught me on the chin, and I thought, only one way to sort of teach him not to do that. So I whacked him back. And then after that, he didn't hit me again.
Was that the take that got into the film, I wonder?
Probably was. Probably, yeah, the most realistic one of the lot, yeah.
In 1987, you filmed The Tale of Ruby Rose, which is about a traumatised woman alone in Tasmania, right in the wilderness in Tasmania. Tell me about the shooting conditions of making that movie out in the Tasmanian wilderness.
Well, that was shot at the walls of Jerusalem, which is sort of central highlands of Tasmania, sort of in from Cradle Mountain and all that, further in from there.
God, that's beautiful there.
It's stunning. Amazing, it is a stunning area.
That hard to get to.
Yeah, the idea for the production was that we would be flying in by helicopters, and that we would be supplied by a helicopter that could go in and out from our site to the roadhead and then bring stuff in. They put in aluminium garden sheds in the earlier in the year for us to live in through the winter. No insulation inside them, just one layer of tin, you know, or aluminium. And unfortunately, that winter became one of the harshest winters on record, and the army that was manoeuvring in the next valley pulled out. It was too much for them to maintain the exercise that they were doing.
Too cold for the army, but not too cold for actors?
That's it, yeah, exactly. And don't forget that we're shooting a story that takes place in the 1920s, 30s sort of time, and so we're not wearing the puffer jackets or anything like that. We're wearing clothes of that period.
I've never been so cold in my life as when I went to Cradle Mountain.
But when we got there, we had to walk in and carry all our packs on our backs, and it took some hours to get from where the road finished just outside of Mole Creek through to the walls. And we expected there to be some people there and some food and all of that, but when we got there, there was nobody there and no food there or anything else. Now, in preparation for this, I'd been taught a lot about how to survive in those conditions and how the early farmers worked there by an extraordinary man called Harold Riley, who was still farming very much with all that knowledge himself. And he taught me how to snare, kill and skin a wallaby. And you could do the killing and skinning in 20 seconds. He showed me how to set the snares up. So we had some wallabies there that we'd caught and snared and already killed. And I skinned those, and there was a farmstead there which they'd got permission from the parks to put a vegetable garden in, which had been growing for some months. And so there were mature Brussels sprout plants, there were carrots and everything else. So I trimmed the Brussels sprouts off of one side of the plant so we could turn the plants around to face the camera so they'd always appeared like they were there.
This is essentially the same solution you had to you getting punched in the face, really. Shoot the thing in profile.
Was that's it, right? Yeah, shoot it in profile. Yeah. If there's a problem, shoot it in profile. Right. That's it. Yeah. And the carrots we just cut off below the ground. And we lived on wallaby and Brussels sprout and carrot casserole and drank whiskey because we'd carried whiskey in because beer would have been too heavy, you know. For a few days, and we had a CB radio with us, and I climbed the highest part of the walls and then just put out what they call a CQ, a general call. Anyone listening, please respond. And a truck driver answered and said he was on the Midland Highway heading down to Hobart. I said, well, would you mind ringing this number and telling them we're at the walls and there's nothing here, no food or anything else? So he passed the message on to the producers, and not long after that, people started to arrive. But it was a magic thing to be part of. We were dressed as the characters would have been dressed at that time. And Harold, you know, if we stopped for any length of time, he'd sneak behind a bit of a rock out of the wind and get a little fire going, and you'd see him sitting around there. I'd get round with him, and he would pick red-hot embers up out of the fire in his bare hands and then just roll them gently up and down. I said, isn't that burning you? He said, no, no, that'll just warm your hands up. So I got into doing that, all little tricks like that. It was a wonderful thing to be part of.
After you and Wendy Hughes had parted ways in the early 90s, you went to Kiribati with your second wife, Dr. Gillian Deakin. Tell me about what brought you over to the island of Kiribati.
Well, Gillian had picked up this job to complete a vitamin A program for the population of Kiribati that was had been put in place by this aid agency that was an American-Australian aid agency. But she had taken that on and was going there with the kids, and I said, well, I better come with you to help look after the kids, you know. So we end up in Kiribati, and to get to Kiribati, you've got to go through Nauru. But Kiribati is pretty amazing. They're just coral atolls, and most people live just in like a wooden frame with a raised floor and a pandanus thatch roof, no walls or anything else, and they just lie there. The weather's always the same sort of temperature, 30-something degrees. The wind only ever blows at about 5 kilometres an hour, firstly in one direction for half the year and then the other direction for the other half of the year, and it's cyclone-free.
So there it's remote, but it's like a paradise.
Well, it's not really a paradise. I mean, if you took a still shot, it looks like paradise. But if you stay there for a long period of time, you realise that it can be quite demanding and destructive in a lot of ways. And people learnt that I had a background in film and theatre and things like that. And the broadcast, the Kiribati Radio Company, which is a government radio station. Producer from there came to me and he said, look, we've got this problem. We've been asked by the government to create a program to try and raise awareness of these issues. Or what? Do you have any thoughts on how we could do it? And I said, yeah, sure. We'll make a soapy.
A soapy?
A radio soapy. We'll have a fictitious island, and we'll have all these families on the island, and we'll have the issues that you want to raise can come up. Not right in your face all the time. So we'll need to start off and establish the relationship between the people and the different families and what they do. And then we'll bring those elements in. And there was a campus for the University of the South Pacific there. And so using the students from there, I worked with them to improvise the scenes that could create the soapy and taught them how to selectively take parts that to create their script. And then we started to record them, and I taught them how you would direct a radio play, and remembering back to the days in the 70s when I was doing radio plays at the ABC as an actor. And it worked.
Tell me how you introduced movies to this place.
Oh, well, I didn't. They were there. What happened is that each village has a longhouse, a maniaba. And the maniaba is where everything takes place. Like if they've got a problem, each family has a post or a pillar in the maniaba. They sit at that and they put their case to the head of the village and, you know, make a decision about something that way. Some of them had little tiny, you know, 9-inch or 12-inch square TV sets that, as I said before, the merchant seamen had bought back. But the merchant seamen also bought back videos, VHSs, on everything. Films on everything in the world. But the people of the islands watching this thought that that is real. That's what the world is like. They didn't have an understanding of a fictitious story or anything like that.
And what did they ever see you
they
on
did.
One of these screens?
Now, this is, there was a film screened in our local Maniaba, and I went down to the village one day for a party. I think it was a Saturday night. I went in and I was there chatting away with some friends. Three local guys come through the door. They see me, they scream and run out. I thought, oh, I wonder what that's about. So the next day I go down in the village and everyone's sort of shying away from me, and I went up to a bloke I knew who, you know, he would be understanding a lot more than anyone else about my position in that culture, and I said, what's up with everyone? He said, oh, you're dead. I said, what? What do you mean? I'm going to be killed? He said, no, no. He said, they saw you die in the movie. Oh. So as far as they're concerned, you're dead, so what they're seeing now is a ghost. So you are now a ghost. Now, the word for European or white person is imatang, and that's the same word as the word for ghost, because ghosts are white. So I was a real imatang, a real ghost. This paid off in that one of the things we were doing, there were market gardens had been started up to grow vegetables to get the vitamin A back into the population. But of course, all the expats that were there, there weren't many, but would buy all the vegetables because these were fresh vegetables. And the men that were growing it had a little bit of money, enough to buy a ute. Now, that ute was being stopped by what you'd call rascals there who'd drop a coconut palm across the road, and they'd rob the men of their money. But then word got out that the ghost would be with the men to look after them, and the robbery stopped.
The ghost who walks.
That's it, on the ghost.
Here that
That's it, yeah. Yeah.
Your first wife, Wendy Hughes, died from cancer some years ago. Did you remain close with her after you
split? Oh, we did. The family stayed really close. I mean, Charlotte, our daughter, moved between the two of us easily. We would party together. We would go out together. We stayed with them in the States, and they would come and stay with us at Bondi and all of that. It was great.
Were you with her close to the end?
Yeah, when she died, we were there. Yeah. The whole family gathered round for that.
How was she towards the end?
Oh, she was as out there as she ever was, you know. I mean, this was bloody bad luck and rotten, you know, as far as she was concerned. But she went into hospice care in the local hospital, hated it. So she rang up her pal who lived next door. She said, come and get me out of here, will you? So she came in through the back door, picked up all the medication that was on the cupboard next to her bed, got Wendy, went out the back door, and they drove home. And once they'd got back there, a few hours later, Wendy said, I haven't got all the medication. Can you go back and get the rest of it? So the woman went back to the hospice and went up to the nurse at the desk and said, oh, can I have the rest of Wendy Hughes's medication? She said, no, what for? She needs it. She's over there in a bed. She said, no, she's not in a bed. She's back at home, you know. That was Wendy. She was just wonderful.
Your latest film coming out soon is called The Way, My Way. We mentioned it before. It's based on Bill Bennett's memoir of walking the Camino de Santiago in Spain. That brought you on the pilgrimage trail? Was that a new kind of experience for you?
Look, you have to understand that the people that are walking the Camino de Santiago are walking that trail, I think, I would say, to empty their heads, to give themselves the space. I mean, you could do it by meditating. But walking the Camino, you haven't got any bills arriving. You've only got the clothes you need, you know, to do that walk for a month or whatever. But I wasn't doing that. I was working on a film, and I had to work 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. I had to be prepared for what I needed to do that day physically. So I wasn't actually doing a pilgrimage. I was creating the illusion of doing a pilgrimage. But you become aware of why it works and why it's been going on for over 1,000 years, well over 1,000 years.
Because it's not meditating, it's putting one foot in front of the other. Is there something in that, do you think?
Well, that can be meditative quite easily. I mean, you just set up a rhythm and you're just going with that rhythm. Probably to begin with, you've got all your problems pounding through your head, and progressively, I think you shed those. You give yourself the space to think through and deal with the issues that you have. In this particular Camino, you go from the French Basque country through the Spanish Basque country and up over the top of the Pyrenees, through the great cities across Spain until you get to Santiago de Compostela, which is the purpose of that pilgrimage, because there in the crypt under the altar is the remains of St. James.
When I think of how many films you've been in, Chris, over the years, I just think how well you've done in Australian film. I'm sure Hollywood was interested in you, but you must have, said no. Did you say no?
I was very happy being in Australia. It was important to get Australia out there in the world.
Chris, it's been just brilliant speaking with you about your amazing career. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Richard. It's lovely to come in here.
Chris Hayward will be appearing shortly in the movie The Way, My Way. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Ah, kids. 1 minute you're cuddling them in your arms, and the next, they've morphed into a teenager. And now suddenly you've got to figure out how to parent in a whole new way. I'm Bec Sparrow, and on this season of Parental as Anything, we're talking teens. How to navigate the hormones, the dramas, and all of the many changes while staying mostly sane. From what to do if your teen is hassling someone for nudes.
She was like, more of what? And eventually he just went, nude pic. I was horrified that my boy could do this.
To how to handle the pressure to let them drink.
You have kids who push buttons, and if a kid wants to drink, you know what? They're going to find a way.
We look at dealing with big teenage emotions.
She was extremely emotional to the point of saying things like, no one likes me, I hate school.
And how to break through to your teen when they've shut you out.
It's difficult because I don't feel like I know how to connect with him.
Plus, there's so much more. So join me, Bec Sparrow, for this season of Parental as Anything Teens. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you listen.